Welcome to the Community Action League. The Community Action League is a weekly show that is a collaborative effort of local organizations and nonprofits. Our goal is to raise awareness of issues that impact people in the Gallatin County, like consent, housing, transportation, human rights, and addiction. We also discuss the organizations that listeners can engage with that are relevant to those topics. On our show, we discuss the intersectionality, or connections, between these topics at the local, national, and global levels. If you are interested, you can tune in to KGVM 95.9 Bozeman to learn more about issues impacting your community every Thursday at 7 p.m. My name is Emma, and I am the president of the Heart Initiative, which is a student organization at MSU that works to raise awareness and educate on human trafficking. So human trafficking is exploitation for sex, labor, organs, and more, and it does happen right here in Montana and in Gallatin County. I am a junior at Montana State studying political science, economics, and sociology, and I am going to let Erica introduce herself because today we are going to be talking with the Society of American Indian Graduate Students about contemporary issues facing Native communities and the historical context for those. So, without further ado.
Hi, I'm Erica Ross. I'm a graduate student here in Native American Studies. I'm non-Native, and I am the Vice President of the Society of American Indian Graduate Students.
Hi, my name is Kristen Falcon. I'm an enrolled member of the Blackfeet Tribe. I'm here as an undergrad studying business management, Native American studies. I am also an ambassador for the American Indian College Fund and work with the Return to Learn program here at Montana State University, and also a member of SAGES.
I'm Pat Jeffers. I'm from the Sault Ste. Marie Band of Chippewa up in Michigan. I'm the president of SAGES and a grad student in the Native American Studies department.
So I've attended a few of SAGES meetings, and I know that we've talked a bit about food sovereignty, but for the listeners who aren't aware of what that is, can you talk a little bit more about that?
So as far as food sovereignty, it's mostly about decolonizing not only ourselves, but decolonizing our diet. When we think about how we used to live as a people before colonization, you know, we lived off the land and we just had a different energy that we had that connected us with this land. You know, everything that we ate and hunted was all natural, you know, from this earth and whatnot. And after colonization, how we were given rations, and then after that, the commodity foods program and whatnot, it not only messed up our whole diet, but just we lost that connection with the earth. So trying to get food sovereignty back into reservations is not only decolonizing ourselves, but finding self-determination through food in a way of decolonizing ourselves and, you know, finding our own.
For those of you that might not know what sovereignty means, it's not often a word that everyone hears in their day-to-day life, including our old president, George W. Bush, who described it as being sovereign, as his definition. So not everyone knows it, but sovereignty is the ability to make and enforce your own laws. So having food sovereignty would basically mean the ability to harvest and grow your own food within the reservation, within tribal land.
Yeah, beyond to hunting and fishing licenses, kind of going beyond that, that right now we live in a place where the state has a lot of control over anyone being able to go and forage from any lands, especially if they're privately owned lands or sometimes public lands have restrictions. So for Indigenous communities, food sovereignty is all about getting back to a place before those laws intersected their right to live sustainably off the land.
And I know, like, some fishing rights and, like, whaling, that can be really impacted by government regulations and laws. And so, like, government legislation can really interfere with, like, the historical practices and traditions.
Yes.
So, like, a big act that's in place that was put in December 3rd, 1993, is the American Indian Agricultural Resource Management Act, the public law of 103, which a lot of the reservations here or trying to put in resource or into place with their programs on each reservation. And one of the reservations right now that are doing a big part of this law or incorporating a big part of this law is the Blackfeet Nation with their ARMP program, just trying to get that self-determination back and trying to, you know, use their agricultural resources for their own use, trying to create food sovereignty back into the Blackfeet Reservation.
Yeah, and I think too that it also has a lot to do with right now, like how we have a food administration that regulates a lot of our food. Unfortunately, though, like food administration regulations also include a lot of like unhealthy policies. We've just heard again about romaine lettuce being contaminated twice this year with E. coli. So food sovereignty for Native Nations takes it out of the federal government supervision, where FDA regulations don't need to be. Sovereignty, having the right to make and enforce your own laws, is not just about government. It's not just about making laws for your people, but it's about like everything from the right to eat what you can grow in your place, or the right to be able to grow and hunt in your native lands, all the way to protecting yourself, your children, and everything else in between. So sovereignty is kind of complex, but when looking just at food sovereignty, you're narrowing that really complex idea down to something pretty basic for everybody, and that's the right to eat, mm-hmm. the right to have access to those type of foods.
Yeah, and that kind of reminds me of the concept of food deserts. So it's definitely not like the sovereign mm-hmm. part of it, but it definitely intersects with like marginalized communities and how like in urban or rural, like in more concentrated like poor areas, then oftentimes there's not a lot of like fresh food that's available, or there's like only gas stations, and so it's like cheap unhealthy food which really impacts people's health. Mm-hmm. So do you see that as being part of food sovereignty?
Yeah, of course. I mean, a lot of times, even on reservations, if you're passing through a reservation, most of the time you're not seeing grocery stores that are on reservations. And if you do see a grocery store, or as in like a gas station that's close to a reservation or on a reservation, you go into those gas stations and you are not going to find one fresh piece of anything, vegetable, fruit. What you're going to see is fried food, chips, soda, pop. And, you know, it's not only cheap and whatnot, but it deteriorates our health, and not just the way that people think or hear about, mostly with like diabetes, heart disease, things like that. A lot of times what we're not taking account is also the depression and anxiety and the mental illness and all the things that are going to this. And we're seeing such high rates of suicide on reservations, and you know, there's a lot we could tie it back to, historical trauma, generational trauma, things like that. But a number one thing a lot of people pass up is food sovereignty, is actual food. What are we putting in our bodies? If we keep poisoning our bodies with this food that's not actually food, that we do not know where this food is coming from. We do not know the factories where it's coming from. We don't know what lands it's coming from. And that's just a huge way to get ourselves back in line, get ourselves back connected with this earth, is bringing back that sovereignty on the reservation, so that, you know, like Erica was saying, just the basic need to eat.
Yeah.
It's all so many issues.
Yeah, food deserts are something that's plagues a lot of reservations. When reservations were created with federal law, most reservations were tribal lands anyway, were secluded to really poor parts of the earth that could not sustain farms, that could not sustain large heads of cattle or bison, really parts of land where you can't grow a lot of natural food. So food deserts are something that have been identified, not just among Indian country, but like you said, in other poorer parts. We see it in marginalized community, in poverty areas across the U.S. A lot of things that have been done, at least that I've been hearing about trying to solve the food desert issue in Indian country, has to do with those like grow trailers, those grow houses, where it's like literally, it's like a trailer, like and yeah, and it contains really good earth and really an available place for people to use as kind of like a greenhouse, mm-hmm. an indoor greenhouse, which is important for a place like Montana since our growing season is so short. Mm-hmm. But those grow trailers I've seen have been making a big impact across Indian country.
So it sounds like legislation is a
big part to play in this and even the creation of reservations. Do you think that you could talk a little bit more about that, Pat?
Oh, yeah. So one of the big things with food sovereignty, one of the big topics, one of the reasons it's so bad in the first place stems from the treaties that were made initially with every separate tribe, which, again, I feel like it's always important to mention that all the tribes are different. All of the food sovereignty efforts in every nation are all different. They're working with different types of food. You're going to see more agricultural things when you go east, and you're going to see more fish-related things when you go to the Great Lakes, and you're going to see more plains-related things when you're in the Great Plains, and you're going to see more salmon-related things when you're in the Pacific Northwest. So they're all different, but they're all working towards the same end goal. But the stem where a lot of this originates from is this concept of reserved rights. When you're looking at treaties, one of the things that was stipulated in treaties was the right to fish and hunt in any and all accustomed places of that tribe in question. And that's referred to as reserved rights, the reserved rights to fish and hunt in these locations. So a lot of these fights for food sovereignty and the ability to do these things are actually already within the treaties themselves. It's the treaties to this day are the supreme law of the land. So this exists, but a lot of these fights for food sovereignty, when you see the struggles, it's usually struggles against other communities that inhabit the same areas or with the government itself. So there's a good example of this that I like to tell my own class when I'm teaching, and it's the story of the Walleye Wars out in Wisconsin and Minnesota. And this took place in the started in the early mid-80s and went on till about 2003-2004. With a Supreme Court act. But it started with the Tribble Brothers, who were two Ojibwe men in Minnesota that were trying to spearfish outside of normal spearfishing season. They didn't have their official permits. So when the police rolled up on them, they were asking, "So what are you doing here? Where's your permit?" And the Tribble Brothers pulled out their treaty and showed them on their treaty rights. Like, we have the right to spearfish here whenever we'd like due to our treaty rights. And they immediately got arrested. And this led to a big, I guess my dad would say, kerfuffle about who has the ability, like what are these reserved rights about, and why should they be enforced, or what are the positive aspects of it? And there is a big outcry because at the time Wisconsin had been dealing with, and Minnesota had been dealing with a decrease in tourism. So there'd been a big loss of income. And a lot of people thought that this loss of income came from overfishing from the native tribes. So there is a big fight about this, which ended in a case called Minnesota v. Mille Lacs Band of Chippewa in 2003, which basically confirmed their reserved rights and enabled them to continue doing this.
And was that a Supreme Court case?
Yes, that's a Supreme Court case.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of like the O'Hara case, the Crow have with Wyoming.
Ooh, I'm not familiar with that one.
Yeah, can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah.
So the O'Hara case, I hope I'm saying it right or whatnot, I'm pretty sure it was in 2013, but I totally could be wrong on that. Just that a Crow man went hunting on treaty lands, but was on the Wyoming border when the Fish and Wildlife came up. He already, it was either elk or deer or something, I'm so bad at the story. Anyways, so he killed this animal. Mammal or whatnot in hunting season. However, because it was on the Wyoming border, he got in trouble, even though that part of the border was part of their treaty, which they were able to hunt and gather on. However, this case also went to...
It sounds a lot like the Nez Perce story with the bison that was killed in Yellowstone. It happened a couple years ago, and like it literally made national news on the Today. Like the next morning, the Today show was showing. Someone had caught a video of a Nez Perce boy who was hunting bison that happened to be in the Yellowstone Park. Because the Nez Perce Treaty allows them to hunt bison in the Yellowstone Park.
Yep.
Well, this boy shot and killed one of the Yellowstone bison, and these tourists were filming it, and it just went viral. And there was just such a misunderstanding of why this boy was even there, how he could do this, what right did he have. It led to some really harsh accusations, throwing it all the way back to that like savage word about native hunting. And the reality of it is that this boy, being an enrolled member of this tribe who had a previous treaty with the U.S. government that is older than we can even imagine, has reserved rights to be there, to hunt that animal, even if it is in Yellowstone Park, even if that animal is a member of that protected community, that tribe has the access to it. It sounds a lot like what you're saying here with the man, the Crow man, who was hunting, and ultimately his hunt had been intersected by boundaries that weren't there when his treaty was signed, when his community treaty was signed.
When you're talking about how they caught this, you know, kid on video and whatnot, and this video went viral, it's thinking, like, how come things like that go viral? As in, like, the misunderstanding, like, misunderstanding as in natives doing something wrong. Why does that go viral? But why do things like girls going missing, native women going missing, why is that not going viral? Like, as much as, like, oh, the wrongdoings of this, like, this young man.
Not even wrongdoings.
Not even the wrongdoings, but in the eyes of the public, you know, on social media, on media, on the news and whatnot. Why is this public? But why is MMIW issues not as much of an issue?
Yeah,
like, let's be honest here.
It seems pretty shocking to me that, like, that is within the treaty rights, yet it takes, like, a case to go all the way to the Supreme Court in order for it to be, like, actually acknowledged that, yeah, this is, like, within your rights. But then you mentioned, like, the missing and murdered Indigenous women, where women and girls are being victimized and going missing and murdered, but yet there's not that much attention on that when they are, like, the victims instead of the purported criminals.
Yeah, I think that, you know, as a non-native in this room, I would like to address this from a non-native standpoint, that ultimately, non-native, I'm from the white community. I identify as white. I was raised as such. So I'm gonna push back on my community here then. So from white gaze, we have a real bad tendency to look at anyone that we don't know or understand and immediately find fault in what they're doing, as opposed to trying to understand what they're doing or why they can even do that, like in the case with the Nez Perce boy. But then we also have a really bad tendency about being silent when it comes to things that we are also responsible for. Missing and murdered Indigenous women, I don't know if you could actually live in the U.S. and not know what that is. Hopefully at this point, hopefully it's been loud enough. I hope it keeps getting louder. No. But missing and murdered Indigenous women is a loud conversation going on. It's for those that don't know, it's an international issue impacting all of North America, even down into South America. Mm-hmm. It's the issue of Native American women being taken. They're going missing. They're being kidnapped. They're being murdered at astronomical rates. And 90% of the victimizers are non-Native men. So here we have that instance I was talking about where white community from the outside likes to look at this instance like with the Nez Perce boy, and we don't understand. We don't have any idea what's going on. We don't even consider treaty rights, and we're instantly blaming that he did something wrong when he did not do anything wrong at all. But when we know we have a role in a situation like missing and murdered Indigenous women, this like community is silent. Mm-hmm. The silence is deafening from the community that's responsible for missing and murdered Indigenous women, for sure.
Yeah.
Especially when you view that, again, going back to law, from a law situation, there's a special relationship between Native peoples and Native tribes in the United States government. And while a lot of people don't necessarily agree with it, situation is that of domestic dependent nations, as stipulated in U.S. v. Georgia, back in 1831, yeah. One of the founding cases of federal Indian law, basically stipulates that even though all Native nations are sovereign nations within their own right and have the right to, handle their own affairs, they're still under the guise or under the protection of the United States government, like a guardian to a ward, like a dad looking over his son is kind of the analogy that they wanted to make. So it's interesting when you see some of these conflicts and you see people get all upset about a young boy killing a buffalo in a traditional way. But then, you know, when where's this guardian when we have, 80% of Native women, Erica?
86% of Native women experience violence in their lifetime. Mm-hmm. And 90% of those violent offenders are non-Native men. Mm-hmm. So you bring up a really good question. Where is the federal government? Where is that guardian? why isn't protection there?
It seems to really fall back into like that overarching narrative that was there from the beginning of like Native people as savages and the white man's burden of like white people having to like civilize like the savages. Mm-hmm. And it really fits into that narrative.
Yeah, unfortunately, I just don't. That narrative is old and played out, and I just unfortunately, it's still existing though. I think that like, gosh, I just get so frustrated being here on campus and in the graduate program. We also teach the 105 introductory to Native American Studies classes, and one of the hardest arguments to have your students overcome within themselves is the idea that like Native people need your help.
Yeah.
Like Native people have existed on this continent since time immemorial, since before European people even knew that this land existed, and they will continue to exist on this continent long after everybody else is gone. I think we have to remove ourselves from the idea that we need to be a part of their solution. If you're part of the problem, you cannot also be part of the solution. Mm-hmm.
It's that white savior complex.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think another part of the being a part of the solution is talking about holding our men accountable. Like we're saying, how most of these women are being taken by white men. You know, it's just not having Native women being taken, but it's also the other things that are happening just right in our backyard, such as Native women being constantly sexualized, even here on this campus. I mean, we can go into things of just how, like, the romanticizing of Native women. Like, where does this all tie into, like, the romanticizing of Native women and then having this connected to MMIW? What is going on here?
And you bring up a good point about Native men as well, because even though the statistics show that Native men aren't the abuser, they're not the person in this situation that commits the crime, but Native men have to step up too, because why are these women leaving?
Mm-hmm.
They're leaving because a lot of them are trying to get out of an abusive relationship. Mm-hmm. They're leaving the res. They're becoming targets. They're easier to be targeted when they leave home. They run away from home. A lot of these women are young. Mm-hmm. They're trying to escape situation that either abusive fathers, abusive boyfriends, Native men aren't not part of the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And we
right.
need to step it up.
Yeah, let's not, I mean, not excluding, we're not protecting Native men. And I love Native men. I myself gave birth to a son who is Native. However, they need to be held accountable.
You know, it's just missing and murdered Indigenous women as like an overall concept is something that is incredibly painful for anyone who's looked into it at all. I'm not, like I've said many times, I'm not Native, and I don't have to be in order to see this as a problem and to demand that things be done. So as a general concept, you know, like if we think about why is this happening, trying to answer the why. Kristen, you brought up the hypersexualization of Native women. Native women are sexualized and racially degraded to really two identities, that you're either Pocahontas
mm-hmm.
or you're not.
Yeah.
You could also bring it's Pocahontas or something that we've been seeing, at least on social media, with a new clothing brand called the Spunky Squaw.
Yeah.
And that's the word. That's,
you know, I didn't want to say it.
One.
I didn't want to say it because it's a curse word. It's a slur.
Mm-hmm.
It's pejorative.
Yep.
It's derogatory. You know.
It's a clothing company or what is it?
Yeah. There's a clothing company that launched this like really kind of like country chicken backyard chic. You know, Oklahoma. I'm from Oklahoma, so I feel fine taking that shot. the style, and they call themselves the Spunky Squaw, but that word, squaw, is so loaded. It's heavy. It carries a lot of racial tension.
Mm-hmm.
So this sexualization of Native women, if they do not meet the standards that the person is sexualizing them, if they don't actually, you know, return the sexual advances kindly, then they're no longer considered Pocahontas. They're considered the
mm-hmm.
other term.
We can say the S word.
We'll say the S word.
Yeah.
Just say the S word. Don't say the S word, but say the S word.
Yeah.
Just know it's there.
Yeah. So I think that we have that as one of the problems, the way that the the world around us looks at Native women still in those two categories. But I think we also have to talk about why this is happening to missing, like why missing and murdered Indigenous women is a thing. Also has a lot to do with what we've been bringing up over and over again, and that is law and jurisdiction. If there's anything that I wish people could learn about Indian country, it is that jurisdiction and law is incredibly messy. It's incredibly complicated because the federal government has made it that way. Mm-hmm. Not because tribes want it that way, because the federal government has made it that way. As it stands, tribes, tribal government, and tribal police cannot arrest non-Native offenders on reservations. Mm-hmm. If they do arrest Native men, there was a slight change in that law a couple years ago. But so let's go with this. The slight change in the law allows them to arrest a Native man that has committed domestic violence against his partner. So let's say non-Native man who has a relationship with a Native woman is aggressive or violent to her. The police can respond, tribal police, they can arrest him, but he cannot be charged for a crime with a sentence higher than 3 years. So is it really justice? You know, like, let's really consider, I mean, every case is different, of course. So that's one instance where tribal governments are literally stymied in their effort to even prosecute people who are committing these crimes.
So non-Native people don't face penalties, really, or that
they literally can't. They literally can't because of federal law.
Other than possible ejection from the reservation by the tribal administration, but that's the most they can do on their side.
It's probably pretty difficult to reach. Yeah. But Native people, on the other hand, can be arrested
anywhere, and they are. Yeah. Actually, this is totally tangential, but like Native people, as a matter of fact, they have the highest rate of murder by cop than any other demographic. And I know we hear a lot about Black men, and of course, I'm not taking away from that. Mm-hmm. We don't have to compete with that to realize that it's important. But Native people have the highest demographic of murder by cop. So, you know, they are arrested and you know, tracked at astronomical rates.
Everybody. And this is also goes with women and whatnot, is that not to compete with Black women is that Native women are the number one sexualized, abused, physical abused, verbally abused, any kind of emotionally abused women in America. But that's so overlooked.
There's a little bit of data about that. Native women are about 3 times more likely to experience violence than any other woman. Mm-hmm. So there's, when we start talking about like the actual numbers of women who have been who have experienced this violence, numbers of women who have gone missing, that is where we don't have information.
Yeah, and I think it's, you know, even though there's a lot of people that do not know what MMIW is and things like that, I think it's making its way out there. It's creeping up a really, really dark tunnel, but I think it's coming up there, especially with the new women that had just gotten to Senate.
Elected Sharice Davis from Kansas and Deb Haaland from New Mexico. First two Native women elected. Deb Haaland came out before she was even sworn into office and immediately requested that Congress investigate missing and murdered Indigenous women across the United States. It was followed up actually by our own John Tester. He came out a week later and made a call for Montana because Montana is the fifth state in the nation. Unfortunately, we ranked number 5 in the nation for states with missing and murdered Indigenous women. Billings ranks the 5th city in all the nation with the highest number of missing and murdered Indigenous women. So John Tester came out, he rallied with Deb Haaland and also made a request for Congress to investigate it further. I think that there are good things being done to make this conversation known, to make this conversation louder. I hope that Montanans know about this because of the representation we've had from this state and because where we rank in overall.
Yeah. And if you don't know, just ask. I mean, even if you have to do a little bit of researching on your own, just Googling it. I mean, there's not a lot of data out there, but there are people that are willing to talk about
there's
it.
There's a lot of stories.
Tons of stories.
And then learning more about human trafficking, I know that Native communities and Native women face much higher rates of being trafficked. There are some great studies out of Minnesota that show just like astronomically high rates. And I know that like man camps and like the oil boom
and the new one, the ships, like they're on the
literally being sex trafficked through cargo ships. I just saw that report too. So I think that like when we talk about the missing part of missing and murdered Indigenous women, that's unfortunately, I feel like that's where a lot of our missing Native women are. they're involved in the sex traffic trade.
And it's a lot easier to say, well, they're murdered now, but they're not. They're out there. We just need to look for them. Like, this conversation just needs to get louder.
Yeah, and one thing to note there is, like, sex trafficking is not prostitution. Like, sex trafficking is exploitation.
Right.
It's through force, fraud, or coercion. It's against their will. Oftentimes, it's very, like, dangerous, very, like, cruel conditions. There are a lot of
And moved quickly. Sex trafficking has a lot of really, really quick movement. I think in Montana, it's really, unfortunately, it's easy for sex trafficking to exist in Montana because we are such a big state. I mean, it takes 8 to 10 hours to cross the state.
Could you imagine all the women that are going through the High Line?
Yeah. Yeah, and because we also intersect with, we share a border with a different country.
Yeah.
So Montana specifically experiencing this issue, I think those might be part of our reasons. I think another one of the reasons why we experience here in Montana is because of resources, resource extraction. You mentioned just briefly man camps. So companies that are extracting resources, whether it's coal or lumber, they develop these things, these camps called man camps. And it's literal, like, you know, 250, 300 trailers that are set up, small trailers, so that the men who are employed by these companies, these companies employ men at a higher rate than women do, than they employ women. These men that are coming out and working on these resource extraction places, they live in these camps. And families aren't allowed in these camps. They're there just temporarily while they're doing their shift. A lot of times these resource extraction shifts they're on like a week, and then they'll be off a week. They'll be on for 10 days and then off for 10 days. So they have like a really hard labor schedule where they're working consistently for a long time. So that's why those camps exist. The men stay there while they're working for those places. Most of these men, though, don't live in this area. They're not from here.
Yeah.
Once their shift is done, they go back to they fly home to wherever their family is, and it's most of the time not in the state that they're working in. So in a way, they become like this transient community of just popping in and out. They have no ties to the community.
Yep.
That's where we see a lot of the violence coming from, these particular camps.
And they're making a lot of money, too, and they don't have, like, oftentimes their families with them, and so you get a lot of men with a lot of, like, cash flow, and then you see a lot of, like, exploitation, like sex trafficking happen. And, like, one thing that is pretty interesting, too, is oftentimes we see, like, exploitation of the environment and, like, natural resources and exploitation of humans at the same time. And
I think about, like, as they're raping the ground for all these natural resources, they're also raping our women, too.
Yeah.
As blunt as that may seem.
You know, I hate thinking about, like these men in these man camps have no control, because that's absolutely absurd. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, they have control over themselves and their autonomy and their ability not to be painful and harmful. I don't want to make it sound like we're like, oh, all men are like this, because they're not. They're not. But this is exactly what you talked about earlier, Pat, about men holding men accountable, even non-Native men holding their non-Native male friends accountable for this issue.
And it's difficult as a man, having run into finding my own friends being abusers. It's tough when you find out that a person you've known for about 6 or 7 years abuses his girlfriend. And you have to make yourself clear. You have to tell them that it's wrong.
No, abuse is not an inherent part of being a human.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't buy it. Like, every person is capable of really great things, and every person is capable of really bad things. But, you know, like, non-Native men, just like every other person on this planet, like, they're not programmed any differently to be exceptionally aggressive.
Mm-hmm.
So why are we seeing this?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that's the question of the hour. Why are we still seeing this?
And I don't know why it has to be a discussion.
It really
goes into this joke that I I heard a while back, where there's just this guy that was being accused of being a rapist, and it's not even really a joke. It was kind of framed at it, but he was like, "Stop calling me a rapist," and the guy was like, "Then don't rape." And I feel like that's just easy, right? It seems like it's easy.
I feel
plenty of people have gone their entire lives.
Yeah, exactly. If you're driving a car and you get to a stoplight, are you going to stop when that red light pops up? Or are you going to keep going? Just as in rape, are you going to rape that person, or are you not? Like, just don't rape somebody.
Yeah.
Or steal them.
Or steal them.
Yeah.
Yeah, it just goes back to, like, basic human decency and caring about like the well-being of another human being. Mm-hmm. But I guess if you don't see somebody as human or see yourself as better, then like,
well, I mean, that's the whole thing. That's the whole problem that we see with, I mean, me being a native and whatnot, and just knowing about my own history and my family's history, is that natives in general, we are dehumanized all the time. So things like MMIW and men being shot, and even ICWA, our children being taken away, is that we're not known as much as humans. Like, I'm a human, and so is everyone else in this room, and so are you. And that's just another way for them to dehumanize mm-hmm. us.
Yeah. And up until 1978, it was illegal to practice indigenous religion.
Yeah.
It was almost illegal to be a native person up exactly. until the 1970s.
Yeah, could you imagine not mm-hmm. being able to go smudge? To church? Yeah, I mean, even right, yeah. For our listeners here, could you, I mean, if you do go to church, could you imagine not being able to read your Bible until the 70s? I mean...
Yeah, it's
so
crazy.
It seems so silly, you know. But we're but at the same
and this
time,
is only a generation
disco
away.
Was allowed. Disco was allowed before our religion. It was like
it seems like so impossible that that's true. But at the same time, we're also living in an era where like mascots is a constant conversation that we're having. Indian mascots. We just had the Cleveland Indians retire Chief Wahoo.
Wahoo.
That's one, though, where we're talking about contemporary issues, and if we're talking about Native people being seen as real people, we can't have them being these, like, poorly drawn, mocking caricatures.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Costumes.
Yeah, we don't have, like, a white people's team. We don't have, you know, we
well,
don't...
someone would argue Notre Dame.
Oh, Fighting Irish.
Just mm-hmm. so we can
But Irish were also, discriminated against.
They were also considered mm-hmm. people of yeah. color. Yeah. Their first...
But I think the difference is, at least in my mind, is that the Fighting Irishman for Notre Dame is a leprechaun. Like, at least
right,
as far as I understand.
A fictional creature.
And,
yeah.
Yes, exactly. So it's not really as difficult
natives are
with...
fictional, too, because there's still a lot of people out there like, what? Natives are even alive? Like,
do you live in a teepee?
Do you
ride a horse to school?
I actually don't live in a teepee, but...
You know, and you mentioned it earlier, you didn't call it by the name, but the concept is pan-Indianism, and it's mm-hmm. the idea that all natives across the United States are the same.
Yeah.
And I think that, again, when we talk about natives as real people, we have to deconstruct these stereotypes. We have to deconstruct mascots. We have to deconstruct pan-Indianism and realize that not all natives are the same. Not all natives live... The majority of native communities don't have teepees.
Mm-hmm. I mean, so, even in Montana, the reservations, there's 7 reservations here. Each reservation itself, each tribe is so much different from each other. Yes, we're all Plains Indians, and yes, we did live in teepees at one time, a long time ago, before we were colonized. Let's just mention that. But they're so incredibly different. And if our 7 reservations just in Montana are so much different, could you imagine what all the other reservations in America, how different they maybe are? They are?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, wigwams here. Yeah. No teepees in Michigan.
Wigwams? What are wigwams?
It's,
I don't know what a wigwam is. See, I don't even know what a wigwam mm-hmm. is.
Yeah, pan-Indianism, it's real. It's right here, we don't even know about each other.
Not even the Indian knows about the other Indian.
Wigwams are like dome structures that are made out of branches that are interwoven, and then you put birch bark on top to kind of like insulate.
Oh.
So it's a little bit not as high as a teepee, but maybe a little bit more area to it. I have not been in a very large number of teepees.
The things you learn
so
every
note.
Day.
Right? Exactly. Same with even my specific tribe. We're right on the confluence of all of the Great Lakes in Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan. So we were fishermen. There weren't really horses involved. There wasn't really hunting involved. When you're on the confluence of 3 major Great Lakes, you don't really need to hunt. It's pretty much just fishing. And even in the winter, you ice fish. And ice fishing is really fun. So...
Ooh.
Mm-hmm. I'll take your word for that.
I've always wanted to ice fish.
It's very fun.
I'm really horrible
especially
at
now
ice,
that
though.
You have big drills and you like take a giant drill and drill onto the ice after you drive your truck out onto the ice. You do one thing after the other and each of them seems dumber than the last because you're like, I'm going to drive my truck onto the ice. Now I'm going to drill a hole in this very same ice, but it's so thick that it's not a problem.
See, we don't do that over here. The Plains Indians, we don't trust ice. Yeah. We just see me walking on ice with like reindeer and stilts. Yeah, it's really bad.
Yeah. And, like, how many different languages are there? Like,
different tribes and like just it's incredible.
Our languages share a language root.
Yeah.
Blackfeet and Ojibwe, they're Algonquin language. Algonquin?
Algonquin.
Yeah.
We're getting there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, actually, we just passed Thanksgiving, and help me out, the tribe.
Wampanoag?
The Wampanoag. Yeah. They just had a significant area of their tribal lands taken from them. From the federal government,
the
Mashpee Wampanoag, 2018, Thanksgiving just passed, where everyone celebrates that story.
Yeah,
that's a whole different. Mashpee, they're part of the original people who aided colonizers, who aided Europeans when they landed on this continent, and now here we are, 2018, and they've lost that. You know, the federal government has taken a significant part of their land back. Mm-hmm. I think that when we imagine about Native American people in this country, a lot of people, first of all, don't think that Native American people still exist. So, mm-hmm. you know, you're fighting that uphill battle. But when we do think about Native people, we don't often think about current contemporary issues, like still fighting for your land, still having to argue treaty rights. Like, that seems like something that we would have been done with in the 1700s, the early 1800s, but no. We're still
being assimilated. I mean, you have to think about, you know, just the MMIW just in general, but also ICWA and how it stands
as a whole. The Indian Child Welfare Act.
Yes.
Yeah.
And how it's gone now. It's gone.
Indian Child Welfare Act, it came out in the 70s.
I believe so, like right after, like, late 70s, mid-70s.
Yeah, it's literally because non-Native communities were adopting Native babies as fashion statements.
You could say adopting or buying.
Or buying. Let's not mince terms here.
Was it with the consent of the...
No.
That was the thing.
Being stolen.
A lot of times, like, these court systems and the social services, they thought that Native families or Native moms and dads were not equipped to raise their own children. This may be true in some cases. However, this is true in many other races. However, parents that were well equipped to take away or to raise their children, they had their children taken away and placed into white homes, where not only did they lose their culture, I mean, you got to think about those kids. When they have kids someday, they lost that total identity. And now it's happening again. It's 2018. It's about to be 2019, and it was gone now.
And it's not gone. It's being. Okay. So two different courts in the Ninth Circuit have ruled. Seventh Circuit and Ninth Circuit, I think. It's the step right below the Supreme Court. No. Two courts have ruled that the Indian Child Welfare Act, which was designed to protect Indian children from mm-hmm. being stolen mm-hmm. from Native communities.
And assimilated, kept in their assimilated, own community,
yeah.
communities, kept in the family if
yeah,
possible.
Yeah, encouraged to be kept within the community and within the family. That law is being challenged as claiming unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. Part of me can understand where that argument stems from. So the argument is that these non-Native families wanted to adopt children, and the child that they met with and connected with happened to be a Native child. And the tribal community that this Native child belonged to was having trouble finding any of their relatives that would be willing to take this baby. And so what happened was this family petitioned to adopt the child, and ultimately they were not allowed to adopt the child because they are not Native, and essentially they would be taking that baby out of their community. That child would not grow up with tribal connection. They would not grow up knowing their language, probably or understanding their own food system. Talking about sovereignty right here, like the child-rearing sovereignty, right? Mm-hmm. So this non-Native family went to court, arguing that the law was unconstitutional, that if there's people willing to be parents to a child, it shouldn't matter what their racial identity is. However, we don't consider in this country that being an American Indian, a Native American person, is not a racial identity, it's a political identity. And there is a massive difference. Political identity is an entirely different thing, and Native American people are the only people in this country who have a distinct political identity. What that means is that because of the court rulings that we talked about earlier on back in the 1830s, it was ruled that because Native American people have to depend on the federal government, then they are their own political identity, because they will forever receive different laws from the federal government.
Because they're their own nations, their own countries.
Because they are their own nations, mm-hmm. Yeah. Tribal governments that have been federally recognized are their own nation. We actually had a conversation in our 105 class this week about the Iroquois Confederacy up in mm-hmm. the New York, the New England area. Mm-hmm. They actually aren't U.S. citizens. They have their own citizenship to their nation. Most Native people have dual citizenship with their tribe and then with the United States. Mm-hmm. But the Iroquois Confederacy is a unique situation where they don't have U.S. citizenship. Because they've denied it. They've rejected it. Mm-hmm. They have their own passports. Passports that allow them to enter any country, come back to America.
See, but it's the coming back to America that's the issue. They can go. The Iroquois, people from the Iroquois Nation, or Haudenosaunee as they call themselves, have been all around the world. But the only issues they've only run into, one with Great Britain, going to a lacrosse tournament, which is a sport they invented. They ended up not playing in the finals of the lacrosse sport they invented tournament. And went back home. But their major issues are when they actually come back in the United States, which is funny because, you know, Iroquois Nation, and they probably fly in Buffalo and New York, people that are very aware of the Iroquois Nation, and they're still like,
or should be
not aware. Sure if we acknowledge should these. Be, yeah. Right,
yeah.
Should be.
Yeah, and going off of that, can you talk a little bit to, like, the politics of recognition and the idea of having, like, a marginalized community, like Native Americans, have them be recognized in order for them to have a seat at the table, and how that can potentially be damaging. Because having somebody else define you in order for you to exist, that has some serious consequences.
It's very sticky, and there's issues on every possible side you can imagine, because every tribe has the right to decide what qualifications they have for enrollment of their members. You have a lot of tribes, you've used blood quantum, which is the amount of indigenous ancestry you have in you. Most tribes usually restrict it to a quarter. Some, very few, do half. Some do an eighth. Majority is a quarter. You have to be a quarter of that specific tribe. There are some tribes that do no blood quantum, where you only have to prove your direct lineal ancestry to a member of the original tribal roles.
Wow.
And blood quantum isn't an issue. At least as far as enrollment is concerned. Mm-hmm. But then you run into issues across the board on all of these. So let's say you have blood quantum. Let's say you you have lineal descent. And let's say you're even a quarter of this tribe, but you don't need to prove blood quantum. But if your ancestor was not there the day that they were doing reservation rolls, mm-hmm. oops, sorry, looks like you don't get to be enrolled. Mm-hmm. Let's say, like in my particular case, You try and get enrolled, but there's some ancestral gossipy drama going on between people, and people don't like your ancestors. Oops, you don't get enrolled. There's all of these issues that kind of take place, and you run into people getting upset for one reason or another. I can't get enrolled for this reason. I can't get enrolled for this reason. People start disenrolling people. But then you run into the final problem that I like to describe is just, what would you rather have? So you have people saying, like, oh man, I want to sue this tribal government because I think that they should do descendancy. I don't think they should do blood quantum. But then if you make that step, if you do decide to sue the government, then what comes of it? Because almost every major case with Native American people has to come down to the Supreme Court. So if you're arguing
because they're their own nation.
So if you're arguing that you want to be enrolled because you're an eighth, not a quarter, then you're basically saying that this tribe doesn't have the right to make that choice on their own. So then if one person loses the ability to decide, if one tribe is forced by the government to change their enrollment measures, it's going to domino effect to every single tribe.
Yeah,
so it really becomes tricky. Exactly.
Yeah,
so there's really no easy way to talk about enrollment.
There isn't. And on the different side, the other side of that coin.
this like 10-sided coin.
10-sided coin. Yeah. The other side of that coin, while tribes can determine their enrollment, they can't determine themselves a federally recognized tribe. Mm. The federal government has to, through a process of application, determine if a tribe is really a tribe, which sounds very silly, but it's true. Right now we have 573 federally recognized tribes. There was a few new ones in 2017, 2018, so I could be off. 570, give or take. But like, for instance, here in Montana, the little shell band of Chippewa, they are not federally recognized. They're only state recognized. So while they can set determination of how someone can be a member of their community, they cannot decide that they are a tribe in the eyes of the federal government. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it seems, it's complicated. It's messy. Everything in Indian country is complicated and it's messy because you have this really large federal oversight that makes everything complicated and messy.
Yeah, that's one thing. Even problems that I've run into over here, just going to the school, is still the question I keep getting asked is, oh, do you go to school for free? Or you don't have to pay taxes? Or just simple things like that that are so complicated that a lot of people don't understand. And one thing, I do pay for school. I have a lot of debt.
Yeah.
Just so you guys know.
Yes.
Deconstructing stereotypes.
I also pay taxes. Yes. Lots of taxes.
Yeah, we also pay taxes, even on reservations. I mean, you have to think about it this way. Let's say you have a cattle ranch on a reservation. Yes, that cattle rancher does not have to pay taxes, but do you know why, though? Because the federal government technically owns that reservation. So it'd be pretty much the federal government be paying themselves. So that is the only reason why there is no taxes on reservations.
For the land to the government.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
But then reservations can make their own taxes for like the resources and the tribal. Seriously, we're going down a real dirty path.
If you were looking at us, we're all kind of like looking into the air trying to figure it out in our own heads between land politics and jurisdiction.
It's so much. It's so complicated.
Whenever we start talking about taxes, it just gets complicated.
Yeah, it does.
But just so you know, nothing is free.
Yeah, that stereotype about free education is a huge one. It's... And understanding that like some tribes with the treaties that they signed, they included in their treaty education grants. Mm-hmm. But then like there's a totally different side of education grants that aren't related to treaties. And they're based on like the one here in Montana. The stipulation for here in Montana, you have to be an enrolled member of one of the tribes recognized here. Mm-hmm. There's tons of requirements.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and I have a
question. Your hair has to be a certain length.
No, that
you have to wear certain beaded earrings.
So I have a question for Kristen because I'm not enrolled in my tribal tribe, and I don't know if Blackfeet does this, but could you talk about per caps and what you know about per caps? Because I know that's also a big myth and stereotype of Native peoples.
A lot of times you hear is we get paid. Like, I don't know where this free money is, honestly. I mean, this is a cheesy thing that I always hear from like our grandfathers and uncles, like, oh, if there's free money, then can you tell me where it is so you could sign me up? No, we do not get free money. I mean, the thing is, each reservation has their own per cap. As for the Blackfeet Reservation, we do get a per cap.
And what is a per cap?
Every tribal member gets a certain amount of money.
Yeah, the idea of like money.
Just from like resources or whatnot.
But it's usually not. From what I've heard, it's only like $100.
Maybe $100. So not even for the Blackfeet Reservation, we don't even get $100 and whatnot. And I'm not one.
The stereotype is the month. The stereotype is that like Native people get a free check once a month from the government that they cash on welfare, and it's not.
Yeah, and we live off food stamps and all the other good stuff. However, that's not very true. I very much work a lot, pay for my taxes and my school and whatnot. But for, I guess, the Blackfeet Reservation, we get either $50 or $75, depending if it's a good year, in December. So, we are getting our per cap soon, so I am looking forward to that
$75.
$75! All that free money!
Lunch is on you.
Lunch is not on me, because it's $75.
If you're a member of a tribe that has a casino, then that may stipulate that you do get income once a month. But even that is tricky because it depends on how...
Blackfeet Reservation has a... We have a casino.
Well, it depends on the state law, and it depends on how the casino writings and the law for having that casino. Sometimes it may not go to anyone. It may only be able to go to the state and the tribal government as a whole. So
even the St. Croix Band of Chippewa, when they originally started enrolling, they didn't care what band of Chippewa you were from. You could enroll, if you had Ojibwe, Chippewa blood in you, you could enroll in St. Croix, and it was totally cool. And then they built a casino. So once they built a casino and they started having per caps going around, that was when they started getting all like, man, we want to make sure that there's only St. Croix Chippewa people getting this money. So that's when they started disenrolling. And that's when I was mentioning the lawsuits, because there were some people that were trying to sue the St. Croix, because they're like, I've been St. Croix my whole life. I'd like, even though I know I'm Lac du Flambeau Chippewa, like, I'm from here, this is where I live. Yeah. And there's all these issues around it, but then it really just goes back to enrollment.
So the per cap money either comes from casinos, does it also come from like natural resource extraction?
Yeah, it comes from resource extraction. Tribes have the right to tax companies that that extract resources on their land. It also could come from tribal land held in trust, which is a legal term about land on reservations that technically does belong to the tribe, but it is held in trust by the U.S. government. So there's sometimes that. Also, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, they're the ones that handle that land trust money. So how you get land trust money normally is by, like, you've rented out your land so that way you could have cattle. I think you mentioned that earlier, Kristen, about cattle farming. But again, like, that land has to be agreed upon by all the owners of that land, and that's a whole complicated issue because ownership of land has to do with each generation, each new generation that is born into that family. Land gets dispersed even more. Oh, so confusing. So,
want to talk about fractionation?
So it can come from several different places. But I think the reality of it is, for most Native people, they don't have a per cap. When you're talking about per cap, it's very rare communities. The vast majority of people don't. It's very rare communities, and if they're getting it, it's not much.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There are, of course, those communities that do get a sizable per cap, but that's because their government system, their tribal government, has made distinctions in their own economy. Tribes have their own economy because they have their own government, and because they are their own nation, because they have sovereignty.
Boom.
Full circle.
Full circle.
Well, I think that's a great wrapping spot. Sovereignty. Yes.
Sovereignty.
Sovereignty is just... Is what it is. Sovereign. It's sovereign.
They're just sovereign.
Can George you spell sovereignty?
You know what? That's a question. Okay.
Don't let your autocorrect do it for you.
We're going to end here with a few upcoming events in the spring that both the Heart Initiative and SAGES have coming up. So the Heart Initiative is going to be hosting a big discussion panel called Human Trafficking in Context, and that's going to be held on February 5th from 6 to 8 p.m. And then we're also going to be hosting a CLIF convention, so that is a Collegiate Leaders in the Fight for Freedom convention, aimed at educating, raising awareness about human trafficking for students across the state, but also we would love to have community members and anybody who is interested. So if you would like to learn more about those events, you can visit our website at www.theheartinitiative.wordpress.com. And are there any upcoming events in the spring that you would like to share?
Yes. So, for SAGES specifically, we have our film festival, our, annual film festival, which is March 28th and 29th. And that lines up with the, as we talked about at the beginning, with the American Indian Council's powwow. That's the 29th and the 30th. There might be some more events happening in between then. So stay tuned, but, that's what we have planned so far.
Beyond events, I know we've really talked about quite a bit. We've dove into several different things, and if you're just hearing this, a lot of this for the first time, it can be really confusing. We do actually have a Facebook if you want to learn more information about what we've talked about here. We have a Society of American Indian Graduate Students Facebook. It's just Society of American Indian Graduate Students-MSU. But the Native American Studies Department here on the MSU campus also has a Facebook where we have a lot more conversation happening than from our SAGES Facebook. And then, of course, here on campus, we have a ton of different learning opportunities.
Come to Wilson Hall. Say hi. We'll answer questions.
Yeah.
So today we talked a little bit about food sovereignty, missing and murdered Indigenous women, Supreme Court cases and legislation, treaties, and mascots. So We are so happy that you joined us. If you have a topic that you would like to hear more about or comments for this show, you can contact us at communityactionleague@gmail.com.